Thank you for the wonderful presentation. Now the subject before me is Swami Vivekananda's legacy, a continuation of India's ancient spiritual heritage. Now, when you listen to any talk on Swami Vivekananda, his teachings, his ideas, or his contribution to America or Europe or modern India, one natural impression that we may have in our mind, we may be tempted to believe that these are all Swami Vivekananda's original contributions. People may wrongly believe that Vedanta is a creation of Swami Vivekananda. Now, one point that Swamiji emphasized again and again was, it was not his creation. Swami Vivekananda's presentation of Vedanta was original, his original contribution. But Vedanta is as eternal as the Vedas. To give an example, every statement that Swami Vivekananda made in his first Chicago address can be traced to the original scriptures of India, the Vedas, the Bhagavad Gita, Shiva Mahavibhina Stotra, and so on. Now, Swamiji used to repeat again and again that I have preached only the Upanishads. Now, Upanishads constitute the fundamental eternal teachings of Vedantic tradition, Vedic literature. It is called Shruti. Sruyate and Dharma Anayayiti Shruti. That scripture which preaches about the highest eternal spiritual truths of the whole humanity, not only of Hinduism, but the whole humanity. That scripture that expounds the fundamental spiritual heritage of the whole humanity, that is called Shruti. And Vivekananda said again and again that I have preached only the Upanishads. The Upanishads means the Shruti. And not only that, in one of his most well-known lectures in Madras, which he delivered, is called The Sages of India. Swamiji traces the origin of what he taught in the West. And then he begins his exposition, his description of the evolution of India's spiritual heritage all the way from the Vedas, maybe around 4000 BC. Then he reaches Lord Rama, Krishna, Buddha, Shankaracharya, Ramanuja, and finally Swami Vivekananda comes to Sri Ramakrishna, his own guru. So one of his greatest attributes, in fact, what makes him unique compared to many modern gurus who are coming to America, who want to claim originality for what they are teaching. Vivekananda never claimed originality of what he taught. He said, all these belong to the ancient Vedic tradition, the sages of India. In the Bhagavad Gita, in the fourth chapter, Lord Krishna says, Imam Vivasude Yogam, Vivasvan Manave Praha Manu Rikshakave Abraved. He said, Imam Vivasude Yogam, Proktavanaham Avyam, Vivaktuan Manave Praha Manhu Ikshakave Abraved, Evam Parampara Praptam, Evam Rajashriyo Vidhu, Sakalena Ikamahada, Yogo Nashta Paranda. It comes in the fourth chapter. What Sri Krishna tells is something very interesting. And if you trace the culture and tradition and heritage of most of the Asiatic civilization, you find this strong emphasis on parampara. Parampara means heritage. Some eternal spiritual teachings taught by a succession of great spiritual teachers called acharyas and avataras. They don't create truth. If somebody says, I created truth, I manufacture truth, don't believe him. Because if somebody claims this is known to me only, no one else. Don't believe Vivekananda himself said. And you find a little bit of this in the old Jewish Hebraic tradition. This idea of a succession is called parampara. In fact, that's why when Vivekananda, after preaching in the United States, when he landed in Colombo on his way to India, he makes a very, very remarkable statement. The statement did this: if Manu returned to India today, he won't find himself in a foreign land. He won't be bewildered. He won't find himself in a strange land. I shall try to explain this. Manu is the name of an ancient lawgiver who lived approximately around 1900 BC. Supposed to be the most ancient among the traditional lawgivers of India. In fact, Manu's law had been incorporated to modern Indian constitution. In fact, one of the first things that the British did, was translating Manu's codes, legal system, into modern English. It was done under the instruction of the first Governor General of Bengal. It's called Sir Warren Hastings. In 1784. It was published. So what I'm mentioning is Manu is the name of a great sage who lived approximately in 19th century BC. He is known to be the first lawgiver of Vedic heritage. Swamiji says, if Manu returned to India today, he find the same India is living here. He won't be bewildered. He won't find himself in a strange land. Now, if you go to Egypt, you may see the pyramids, but you don't know how the ancient Egyptians built it. If you go to Angkor Wat in Cambodia, huge Hindu structure in Cambodia, but the same technology, the same architectural style which built this Cambodian Hindu temple in Angkor Wat, you can still find in India people building temples using the same technology. The Bharatanatyam, the dance forms, the music forms, which you find today happening in Sunnyvale and all this all over Bay Area, the original book was written by Bharatamuni, an ancient sage who lived in around 4th century BC. It is called either Bharatamuni Natyashastram, the science of dance forms. So this parampara, this ancient tradition, not only in spirituality or religion, religious philosophy, this has been continuing in India from time immemorial. Vivekananda says, my role is only to hand over this ancient precious heritage to modern world. And his greatest contribution was, he was the first great modern Indian spiritual teacher who expounded Vedanta, who took Vedanta out of India's cultural landscape, who brought it out of Indian subcontinent and who expounded in modern English in the language of people who were questioning creationism after Darwin's publication of The Origin of Species, were questioning different religious traditions. So when religions were being questioned, Vivekananda brought this ancient spiritual heritage, expounded in modern English in such a style, in such a language that even an agnostic cannot actually disbelieve him or contradicting. Vivekananda said, Buddha, according to Vivekananda, was one of the greatest spiritual teachers of human civilization. Buddha did not go to a temple or a church. He was an agnostic. And Vivekananda says, he was one of the greatest spiritual personalities the world has ever produced. No, this is Vivekananda's heritage. One of his unique characteristics was he never denied his own indebtedness to this ancient, what you call, parampara. Parampara means a long succession of teachers and great exponents. Now, coming to his first Chicago address, let us see, I can mention that. You find some very interesting ideas that Swamiji expounded in his Chicago address. Actually, Swamiji must have spoken around 9 minutes. Those of you who may remember please don't mind. Lincoln's great Gettysburg speech, second inaugural address. Lincoln prepared so hard, even when he was being driven to the Gettysburg battleground, he was polishing the quotations from the Bible. Lincoln worked so hard, and it was one of the most marvelous speeches the world has ever heard. Vivekananda never imagined what he was going to speak before he got up to speak. In fact, he was afraid to speak. He tried to postpone his speak. He would talk later. He was nervous. He had never seen such a huge audience which he had to address in Chicago. And, you know, so he is supposed to have delivered he must have supposed to pray to Goddess Saraswati. You say, Saraswati nirtyadu vachi me sada. That's the prayer. And let the Goddess of Learning dance on my tongue. And with this prayer, he stood up, sisters and brothers of America, less than 10 minutes. And that is the foundation of what all we spoke, what all we listened today. Vivekananda began his prophetic mission with a talk that lasted less than 10 minutes. Now, what are the three important teachings in Vivekananda's first Chicago address? First, you know, those of you must have read it, you know, he refers to the Jewish migration to India. According to historians, there were three migrations. 9th century BC, they say, during the time of King Solomon. Then 4th century BC, when the Assyrians destroyed a Jewish synagogue in Jerusalem. Then 70 or 71 AD, when the Masada collapsed. There were three migrations of Jewish people to India. Vivekananda refers to the Jewish diaspora who came to India, and this mother of religions, Hinduism, welcomed them with open hands. Then Vivekananda refers to Zoroastrians. When Iran was overrun by the Arabs, and the ancient Zoroastrians fled to India, and Indian kings and emperors, they give protection to them. Vivekananda doesn't directly refer to, but he implies perhaps, you know, if you go to India, you find a small Christian community who claim that their ancestors came to India in 51 AD. If you believe their claim, which is not disputed completely, St. Thomas, one of the disciples of Jesus, came to India. In fact, some of their descendants still have their churches in this California state. It's called the old Syrian church. So that means when the Roman emperors were throwing the early Christians to lines to make nice breakfast off, Indian rajas and kings and priests were opening the doors and windows, handing over Hindu temples. You take this temple, you convert this to your synagogue. And you can find still one of the oldest synagogues in the world in India. Now, why did this happen? So Swamiji says, Swamiji actually gives a very graphic description of this very interesting chapter of Indian history. Ruchinam vaijitriyad ruchu kudilanana pathasusam nirnamego gammis tamasipayasam arnavaiva. It is a verse that Swamiji doesn't quote in Sanskrit, but he gives an English translation in his first Chicago address. Ruchinam vaichitriyad ruchu kutila nana padajusam nirnam ego gamyas tamasi payasam arnava iva. The destination is one. The goal is one. You may go to God, you may approach God from any angle, following any path. When you reach the highest level of spiritual evolution, the top of the hill, then when you look down, you find so many roads, so many trails leading up to the top of the hill. So when you reach the highest evolution of a spiritual life experience, then you find Eckhart, Jesus, the Upanishad sages, Buddha, Zoroastra, they are all speaking about the same truth, but they speak in different languages. they use different vocabularies. They use different parables and illustrations based on the socio-anthropological conditions of the people among whom they were born. So Swamiji says, all religions are essentially so many roads leading to the same goal, namely spiritual experience. This is one very important message that the Swamiji gave to Western world. Now remember, maybe from the perspective of Abrahamic religions, this may appear to be a new revelation or new truth. But actually, even in the Christian or in the Buddhist tradition, you find there were great men like Eckhart, for example, who spoke of the same supreme transcendental reality. This is one of the center teachings of Swamiji's Chicago address. Now, this again is based on another very important ideal that is found in the Gita. Swamiji actually translates this verse into English in his first Chicago address. Ye thamam pravadyande tan tathaiva bhajamiham mama varma anuvartande manushyaha partha sarvasyaha. Which means, people who practice different religious traditions, different faith systems, they will all reach me. They are all following the real path, which will eventually take them to me. To me means God. So this idea that all religions are essentially equally valid paths leading to the same goal. There is no difference. When you reach the highest destination of a spiritual evolution, you find that all people belong to humanity. So Vasudeva Kutumbaka means the whole humanity is one spiritual family. So this is the second verse that Swamiji directly translates in his Chicago address. Now these two ideas are built upon a much earlier scriptural tradition of India. It is found in the most ancient and the most important religious scripture of Vedantic or Hindu tradition. It's called Rig Veda. So Indram Mitram Varunam Makti Rahu Adho Divyasa Suparna Gurutman Ekam Satvi Prabhugdha Vadandi Apting Yamam Matarishwana Mahu. What it says is this: so many religions, so many names of God, so many languages you use, spiritual seekers, spiritual teachers use to explain, to expound one central truth. These are all so many ways of describing, explaining, interpreting the same one truth. Ekam Sat, reality is one. That reality may be seen, may be explained, may be understood in so many different ways. So there is no such thing as a wrong religion. A person may go wrong because he is not able to practice the real spiritual disciplines, but there is no such thing as a wrong religion. So that's why Swamiji stresses in elsewhere, he mentions one important point. So I already referred to in the beginning. The infinite oneness of the soul is the eternal sanction of all morality, all ethics, all good actions. It's come from the Inspired Talks, one of Swamiji's very well-known talks, which he delivered in New York, a little away from New York, in Thousand Island Park. Swamiji says, the highest and the most profound foundation of universal ethical philosophy is not the fear of God. There are many people who are wonderful people, good people. They would tell you, I won't believe in God. I don't need a God. People tell you that. They're wonderful people. Gandhi, for example, was supposed to be a great pious Hindu. In fact, he went to some temples in order to lead an agitation for the mission of the lower caste Hindus in those days, especially in 1930s, 1920s. He traveled all over India. In fact, he's one of the great reformers. He tried to eradicate casteism, untouchability, all these social injustices which somehow crept into Hindu society during its evolution running to 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 years. So Gandhi was one of the reformers who was inspired by Swami Vivekananda. So he once went to a temple. It's called Temple Entry Proclamation, very important event. He never entered the temple. He stayed there for 21 days, never entered the temple, and is considered to be one of the greatest Hindus by many religious people. So you need not necessarily go to a temple and worship a god. If you can look upon your fellow human beings as your own brothers, your own sisters, if you can love them, you can be compassionate, you can be broad-minded, then you can be spiritual. It is not enough to be religious. You should be spiritual. And spirituality goes beyond religion. That's one of the unique teachings of Vivekananda. It is again founded in many of India's ancient spiritual heritage. I can just refer to one interesting conversation in one of the most prominent devotional classics of Hinduism. It's called Bhagavata Purana. It's in the form of a dialogue, a discussion between 9 sages and a great king. He's called a philosopher king. So among the many questions that the king put to the sages, one question was, who is an ideal spiritual man, spiritual person? Who is a real devotee? Whom God considers as an ideal devotee? So you may imagine somebody who prays, who goes to a temple or a church or a mosque or a synagogue, who reads books, who is vegetarian, and that is what religion implies. And so this question was put to me in one of the debates. They asked me, Swamiji, how can you be spiritual without being vegetarian? Then I told, you know, Christ was not vegetarian. Hitler was vegetarian. Do you think that Hitler was more spiritual than Christ? And it so happened that question happened to be from Jewish tradition. So nobody can understand the meaning of my answer made better, more forcefully than this person. So what I mean to say, so the question was this, who is an ideal devotee? Who is a real spiritual person? The answer given among the 9 sages, Kavir Kavir Andariksha Prabuddha Pippalayana Avihotrodadu Vilas Chamasa Karabhajanaka. 9 sages. The answer was this. The one who sees the presence of God in everyone, and the one who sees the presence of everyone in God, is a real devotee. All other are just going to kindergartens, primary schools in their spiritual life. The one who has reached the university level education in spiritual evolution is the one who sees God in everyone and the one who sees the whole humanity in God. Sarva bhudeshu ya pasyet bhagavad bhavam atmanaha bhudani bhagavadi atmani esha bhagavadottamaha bhagavadanam uttamaha means the highest devotee, the humblest devotee, God's chosen people, chosen person, somebody whom God may love and consider to be his ideal devotee, is the one who sees God not only inside a temple or a church, but rather sees God everywhere. You cannot love God and worship God and go one day for license renewal and then 6 days as you leave. No. You have to practice spirituality every day, every minute, in every action, every thought, every deed. Such a person alone is the ideal devotee. This was the reply given by a sage called Antariksha. Now, this was actually the essence of Vivekananda's teaching of Bhakti Yoga. Now, we may ask this question. If you listen to Swamiji's lectures, if you read his books, you find Swamiji's talking about universal religion. Swamiji's talking about the spiritual unity of humanity, is talking about practical Vedanta. Actually, practical Vedanta is the application of universal religion. Swami Vivekananda comes forward with a unique paradigm, unique religious paradigm, which actually becomes the foundation of what we now understand interfaith dialogue. He said, that means, if every religion is true, and if you reach the top of the hill and then look back, look down, you find so many trails and roads that you could have taken to reach the same place. But when you're following, when you're walking, you're following one track on your way to reach the top of the hill, you think you're the only traveler. You don't know there are so many other roads, other trails in front of you. You'll realize the fact that there are so many paths only when you reach the top of the hill and look down. So Swamiji says, when a person reaches the highest degree of spiritual evolution, then when he reaches what you call spiritual experience, going beyond rituals, mythology, and philosophical debates, then he will realize all religions contain some fundamental universal humanistic truths. But you should look beyond the socio-anthropological landscape, the socio-anthropological conditions under which a prophet is born, is compelled to preach. He may have to use one particular language, one particular kind of illustration, one kind of parables or illustrations, examples. If you look beyond, if you go for the fundamental essence of the great holy scriptures of the world, you find Jesus, Buddha, Shankara, Siddhamakshana, all these great, all other spiritual teachers also speak of the same truth. I can give an example. I had to help a Jesuit priest who was preparing a thesis on comparative study of Eckhartian philosophy and Shankara Sadvaita. He was trying to take a lot of help from Rudolf Otto's translation. He had gone to Germany and stayed for 14 years, studied Old German to study Eckhart in the original. And now, what I found, as I had to go through some of his English translations, of course, Eckhart actually translates many of the statements from Shankaracharya's Bhashya. The very idea of vaya negativa, negative theology, the idea that God cannot be described, God cannot be explained, God cannot be fully understood or interpreted in words or by words. You can understand God only by saying what he is not, because so infinite. So words and ideas and philosophies fail in explaining the reality of God. You know, it's called in the Prama, Sarva Pramana Avadhihi in the Vedantic tradition, beyond all epistemological tools. This idea you find Siddhamakshana, this idea you find in Vivekananda, this idea you find in Meister Eckhart. So, every tradition has produced some unique teachers, sages, who had a vision of this higher experience. When they go beyond rituals, beyond just belief systems, beyond do's and don'ts, when they reach the experience level, srutya, yuktya, swanubhutya, going beyond scriptures, beyond philosophical discussions, when they reach their own inner experience, they speak of the same truth. This is the essence of all that Swami Vivekananda taught in the US and also in Europe, everywhere. What he did was, he brought forth the best of the ancient heritage, the teachings of the ancient sages, and then he practiced in his life, and he passed over the next generation by interpreting the ancient eternal spiritual truths in the language of modern times, in a language that we can understand, in a language that Europeans and Americans in the 19th century could understand and appreciate. So that was a unique contribution of Swami Vivekananda. What it really means is this, Swamiji never claimed originality of what he taught. But the method of presentation, the way he expounded these ancient eternal truths was his own. In fact, that's what happened in the context of India's parampara, mean the succession of great spiritual teachers. They bring forth the best of the ancient treasure, spiritual heritage, which is eternal, and then they practice, they reinterpret and pass over to the next generation. So among these teachers, you find many great teachers in all traditions. But Swamiji says, whatever I taught is Upanishads. And another person Swamiji refers to, he says, if there was something great and grand and positive and wonderful in what I taught, it is all by the grace of my guru, Sri Ramakrishna, who was the embodiment of these ancient spiritual truths. And if there's a problem, it is my blunder. That kind of humility, by being a great philosopher, a teacher who brought a new religious paradigm, new paradigm of interfaith conversation, interfaith dialogue into the Western world, who expounded these ancient truths in a very rational, modern language. With all that, he says, it's all part of the ancient tradition. I got my blessings from my teacher, who are the embodiment of all that I taught. If there's a problem, it is mine. So this aspect, that is, whatever Swamiji taught is actually part of the ancient heritage. But the methods and means, that all belong to Swamiji. So with this I conclude, because we don't have too much time. And you know, I didn't get enough time, but doesn't matter. But you are most welcome. You are most welcome to put any questions. You need not be a believer in Vedanta to ask questions. But agnostics and atheists are more welcome, really speaking. Because one greatness of Vedanta is it opens doors and windows not only to believers. Spirituality goes beyond, it transcends religion. This is one of the unique aspects of Vedanta. Shankaracharya, he renovated many temples, but he never insisted that everyone should go to a temple, perform a particular ritual, then only you can be religious. Swamiji also followed the same path. Swami Vivekananda actually was the disciple of Sri Ramakrishna, who was given sannyasa diksha in this traditional monastic tradition. He was affiliated to one of the 10 monastic orders founded by Shankaracharya in 8th century AD. So you find this 24 centuries from Buddha to Vivekananda. 24 centuries approximately. At the middle, Shankara stands, who renovated the ancient monastic traditions, who interpreted the Vedantic texts, including Bhagavad Gita, which Swamiji says is one of his greatest works. And then Swami Vivekananda and Sri Ramakrishna together came in 19th century. What they gave to America is not, don't misunderstand, it's not some kind of a temple-going religion. It's not against going to temples, but it goes beyond going to temples. Remember, that's an interesting thing. Vedanta doesn't deny anything. Vedanta says you can practice rituals. You can practice the daily rituals, your mechanical practice, nothing wrong. But you should not assume that kindergarten is the end of education. You should go beyond that. So no one can reach the highest experience without going through the intermediary stages of going to temples, churches, synagogues. But you should not deny the presence of God outside the church, outside the temple. You should see God not only inside the temple, but also outside the temple. This is a central message of Vivekananda. So we will have, I believe, we will have an active discussion program. Most of you may have attended this program the last few years. But those who are coming for the first time, and I don't think there are many of them, you should remember, this is actually the most exciting part of the whole Memorial Day program. So we will have Q&A. The program will begin at 1:45 approximately, and it will be over maybe around 4:30. We'll have Vedic chanting, meditation. Then we have two music presentations by your men's choir, who will give a light from the east and the other song, Into the Beyond. Two musical presentations. And before that, please remember, we will have lunch. That's very important, you know. So... So after this, you can see the building. There are six lines. So you can join any of those lines near the men retreat house. And please remember, you should try to return here approximately by 1:45, because the afternoon session is supposed to begin at 1:45. And then we have Q&A, and please remember to return here after lunch at 1:45. Thank you. Thank you. Namaskar.